This is Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak here with John Wells. Well, take a bunch of research scientists who need data collected from all reaches of the globe, and then a bunch of adventurers and globetrotters who thrive on discovery. You combine those two, and what do you get? Well, you get Adventure Scientists. It's a company based out of Bozeman, Montana, that matches adventures with the scientists. It's crowdsourcing for data collection of sorts, and it's what our guest Andrew Howley joins us for today to explain. Howley is the communications director at Adventure Scientists, and prior to that, he logged over 11 years at National Geographic, producing the Society's homepage. He helped build one of the world's largest social media followings on the flagship Facebook account, and wrote or edited hundreds of blog posts by and about explorers in the field. We're very pleased he could join us by phone. Good morning to you, Andrew.
Good morning, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. You know, we heard from you several weeks ago while Park City's delegation, the city tour, came up to Bozeman, and you were one of the city leaders who spoke to this group and talked about Adventure Scientists. And maybe you could just start with the mission. This is so interesting, and I had never heard of something like this before.
Sure. I think you did a great job introducing it. We work with partners in science and conservation to collect the critical data that they need to accomplish their goals that needs to be collected from remote areas. We team them up with the adventurers, outdoor athletes, and outdoor enthusiasts who have the skills to function and explore in those areas, and just train them to get the data that these people need to do their important work for science and conservation.
And so I would imagine that this not only saves time, it saves money going to, you know, the remote reaches of the globe. For those scientists who are collecting data and trying to do their research, I mean, it saves them a lot of time. It enables them to, I guess, fortunately or unfortunately, stay in the lab while these people are going out, mountaineers or explorers or even sometimes just travelers, tourists, to gather this data.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's something that we hear from our scientific partners over and over. I was recently speaking to one of the scientists we worked with several years ago, collecting lichen for some research that she was doing. And she reiterated that she just never could have gotten the samples from the wide geographical base that she was able to get them with the kind of time and resources that she had as a scientist. But with our explorers that were, you know, recruiting and training and managing to collect these samples, you know, at a high quality from wherever they are already going and already able to survive and perform really well, it's relatively easy then to get samples from the tops of mountains in Asia and the tops of mountains in South America.
Andrew, good morning. I wanted to ask you about Neanderthals, if that's okay.
And yeah, absolutely. It doesn't dovetail with my work here at Adventure Scientists too closely, but happy to talk.
Yeah. So for many years, and up until recently, Neanderthals have sort of taken a back seat. They've been viewed as not sharing many traits that make us humans, you know, tool making, communication, producing art. And I was taking a look at your blog, which was fascinating. And I wanted to talk to you about Neanderthals and all the new information that is in the last 20 or 30 years that has come forward, including did they make art. Talk about Neanderthals for us, with us.
Yeah, sure. That is exactly the really exciting thing that's happened over the last 10 years or so, that there's been a shift in looking at this earlier species of humans, which overlapped with modern humans, and as we now know through genetics, actually went into making us who we are. To this day, a large portion of the human population has direct Neanderthal descent. They used to be seen as, you know, a very primitive early form that was based a bit on some of the earliest fossils that were found in the 19th century that were actually of older arthritic member of the society. So while it kind of gave the impression that these people were hunched over and, you know, couldn't move well and struggled just to survive, you know, kind of trapped between ape and man, it was actually early evidence that these people were actually being cared for and had a rich supportive society, that even someone past the age of being able to hunt well was being cared for and supported. So that kind of a sense of their, you know, emotional support had been evidenced through the archaeological record of just, you know, looking at their bones and looking at their population. And over the last 10 years, there's been more and more indications that they were also adorning themselves and decorating their environments and their bodies with various accoutrements, as we would say. Ochre is a natural mineral that is used to color skin and walls and hides, all sorts of things by modern human cultures. And we see used ochre, you know, ochre that basically looks like a big, thick chalk rubbed down until it's been used too far, you know, little stubs of ochre going all the way back, you know, 500,000 years ago. So Neanderthals, who lived about 250,000 years ago, it's about 35,000 years ago, were using ochre like that. New indications show that they're also using animal parts that have no direct functionality, such as harvesting large feathers from birds of prey, or also harvesting their talons and keeping those talons together. And we can see wear patterns that show that they were kind of kept together on a thong or worn as a necklace or somehow put together in a way that doesn't really feed the kids. So it's various bits of evidence that have shown that Neanderthals were, you know, kind of exploring culture and adapting the world around them with cultural meaning, you know, particular to themselves.
So if somebody calls me a Neanderthal, it's a compliment.
Absolutely. wear the tag with pride. These are your ancestors. They say the average European person of European descent has about 3% Neanderthal. That's roughly equivalent to one of your five times great grandfather, you know, living in the 19th century. So people alive today, you have about 32 great grandparents around 18, you know, 50 or so. And if one of those had been a Neanderthal, you'd have that same amount of 3% in you today. But because we all share that 3%, it just kind of keeps current. We keep changing it, swapping it.
Andrew, I can tell you are as much of a sucker for Neanderthals as is John here. You guys could probably go on talking all hour about this topic.
Well, they remind me of the planet Pluto, or I guess it's not a planet anymore. You know, Pluto just got slammed for so many years, and Neanderthals did too. And I'm glad to see the resurgence. And there's a lot more information that's coming out on their cave art and the way they were able to communicate amongst themselves. It's just fascinating.
So I'm going to try to tie the discussion of Neanderthals back into adventure scientists. Let's see if we
Excellent.
Can do this. What do you think? So give us an example of how current research, perhaps on, you know, that scientists are doing in the laboratory on Neanderthals, could be served well by the work of adventure scientists. How's that for a tie-in?
Yeah, sure. you know, the pursuit of knowledge about our ancient ancestors is like the pursuit of any other kind of physical knowledge that we're looking for in the world. And it's really just a hunt for that information. The better trained people can be over a wider area to be attentive to the clues that some of this data is out there, the more we're going to learn. So, you know, in paleoanthropology, it's about training, you know, people to recognize sites. The Homo naledi that I also covered was discovered, you know, by training cavers in South Africa to be on the lookout for hominid remains.
Yeah.
And sure enough, the team was trained to go out and pay attention. And when they saw the bones, they reported it back to the scientists that they were working with, and a full expedition was launched, and they were able to get new material. It's very much the same when we look at any of the projects that we're doing with adventure scientists.
Yeah.
When you have people going out into these remote areas, to the tops of mountains, to hot deserts, to all areas of the ocean, and you're looking for information from there. If you just train these people and get them on board and know how to collect the right data and know what clues to be looking for, they can be the eyes and the ears of this very small population of specialized scientists who know exactly what to look for but can't cover that amount of ground.
Right.
And that's what we really tap into with Adventure Scientists.
And so I'd like to talk about your microplastics project, just so people can get an idea of the scope of your work. But first, you know, I think probably a lot of people who hear about what you do wonder immediately, well, wait a minute, how can you collect data correctly so it doesn't get tainted or adulterated? And Adventure Scientists has a very organized, methodical process for doing this.
Yeah.
Can you explain that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Our projects are really crafted very closely with our scientific and conservation partners from the start. So it's not like we get a call that says, hey, can you collect some water samples? And we say, yeah, sure, we'll get on the phone. It's about very clearly determining what is the goal of the project. What's the conservation outcome that we want to have? What are the scientific data that we're going to need to make that argument or understand that situation better? And then what is the specific protocol that's going to be required for each of our volunteers to collect that data in a way that is going to be rock solid research grade data? And so we work with the scientists who are going to be using the data to develop these protocols. We'll train everyone that participates through online training. Often we'll also be able to get some in-person training, especially when we're doing a more localized project like up here in Montana. And that really brings everybody up to the next level. Once you've gone through your training, then you have to pass the online test and prove that you've learned what you wanted you to learn. And then you're given all of the following information and any kind of materials that you'll need to collect. We also then, you know, kind of eyeball everything, double check things when they come back through us and get to the scientists. So there's really a lot of fail-safe and a lot of careful work that goes into assuring that this data is going to be really research grade and usable by organizations, by research scientists, and by government to put this information into action for Glenn.
For many, many years, science and research was conducted as standalone islands where there was not a lot of sharing of information and there wasn't a lot of cross-discipline input going into research and science. And probably one of the central themes of doing Cool Science Radio, our program we've done for 5 or 6 years now, is that collaboration is king, and there's so much more collaboration going on today. Hand in hand with what you are doing, the crowd is always smarter than any one individual. That makes for pretty good science, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that we've seen over the last couple hundred years is the raising of the general population to a higher scientific level. You know, it used to be that there were only a few people who were looking at the world through that lens, who were learning about the importance of designing clear protocols and following things rigorously and what, you know, these numerical bits of physical information could really tell us about the world. That's something that's really known by everybody that goes through a modern education now. And there's been a lot of media over the last, you know, 30, 40 years that's really made anyone anywhere aware of the power of science and the basic tools that are required to use it. So you have kind of a trained apprenticeship that's pretty much global instead of being the trained apprenticeship of the, you know, two or three smart kids that went and, you know, would stay with the local, you know, astronomer and learn the ropes there. You kind of have a great broad base of knowledge and awareness and appreciation of science that makes it ripe for activation.
Yeah, and we don't have any hard data on this because we don't do surveys, but our sense is that maybe 70-75% of the folks that listen to our program regularly are curious lay people. And that's the exciting thing for me is that there are so many people out there now who believe that understanding our world is important. And they take an actual interest, and they know that they'll never be able to get into the weeds with a particle physicist or with a microbial biologist into that type of detail, but they want to understand what's going on in our world. And I think that there's a resurgence. So that's exciting to all of us here.
Yeah, it's exciting to be a part of it.
Yeah.
So, Andrew, from 2013 to 2017, Adventure Scientists had thousands of trained volunteers going all over the world, from the water to the mountains, to collect samples to see about how plastic has permeated, literally, our world. How ubiquitous is plastic? And I guess we're talking about microplastic pollution.
Right. It is ubiquitous. It's an absolute term, and it fills it entirely. Everywhere that we went, we found evidence of microplastics in the environment. And at times, that was really highly concentrated. At times, it was more thinly concentrated. But there's nowhere that we went that, it took a bunch of samples over a wide area and said, yeah, there's nothing here. Everywhere, there were these microplastics. But to give a little more info about what microplastics are, some people associate the term specifically with microbeads and, very tiny plastics that are produced intentionally to be tiny. And there was some talk about them a few years ago, a lot of regulations that have been put in place to minimize their use and kind of keep them out of the environment. The other kind of microplastics, though, are the microscopic degradation of larger plastics. And that's what we've really found everywhere. And about 90% of that nearly was microfibers degrading from our synthetic textiles. So people associate that a lot with fleeces, like your typical mountain fleece. You're going to go stay warm or, make a kid's set of PJs or have a nice blanket. And these fleeces, especially when they go through the wash, release all the lint that you usually collect up in your dryer vent, your dryer strainer.
Your lint filter.
And that'll catch a lot of the larger lint. A lot of the anything smaller than the holes in that filter, though, is going to go, get washed out either through the air vents of your dryer or through the rinsed water of your washer. And so it's those tiny bits of lint decaying from all kinds of synthetic materials, which is a significant portion of the fabrics that we use. Just getting out into the air and the water and being distributed through those media all around the world. So while we found high concentrations in the ocean, there were thin concentrations even in super remote areas, and that can kind of show the importance of each individual contributor to our project and projects like this, where having thousands of volunteers gives us that great big picture view of the world and where the microplastics are and what concentration. But also each individual can have a major impact. So one expedition that was up above a Himalayan village that found a single microplastic in a water sample gave us that clear indication that you don't have to be downstream of a large modern human population. You can be up in the mountains above the tiniest village nearby, which is very remote, traditional, natural fabric using area, and there still will be microplastics because they're just getting carried everywhere.
Well, as long as we're wearing clothes, those microplastics are going to be around unless we switch all to organic cotton and wool, I suppose. Correct?
Right, yeah. So the one alternative would be to return to kind of the more Neanderthal example of just using, animal hides for clothing, but that carries its own ecological impact.
I'm so glad we could circle back around to Neanderthals.
Oh, yeah, get them back in the conversation.
It's all connected. That's the real lesson of science is how it's connected it all is. So what can we do about this this pollution? And the answer is really that we can be smarter about it. So we didn't know that this was a problem. The people that do know about it or people that are responsible for it know about it now and are making great strides. So companies like Patagonia, who supported our work, but also produces a lot of fleeces, obviously had a big interest in this. And so they've worked to improve their production techniques to minimize the amount of microplastics being degraded out of there. Other companies like Crokey's that makes, the straps to hold your sunglasses on, they're looking at their materials, and they're making recycled materials and not contributing more bits of plastic that can get in. So there's small steps that everyone can make that can end up having a big impact at whatever it is, from your personal level of maybe you could install an extra filter that are available for your washing machine, and then that catches all the microfibers, and then it goes into a landfill eventually, which is not perfect, but it's better than going into the water where it's going to be absorbed right into the food column. Or if you're somebody who's working at a large corporation, you can put changes in place for their production that would help minimize you on that scale.
Mm. Hey, if you're just joining us...
There's no super easy answer, but it's something that, you know, gathering the information is what enables us to then make better decisions going forward. And that's what we're really looking to do as a venture scientist. It's not necessarily solve every problem in the world. It's get the data to make better decisions going forward.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Andrew Howley of Adventure Scientist. Andrew, I'm sure with all the testing we've done for humans in the United States, for an example, that there's a range of what these microparticles might be in everybody's bodies. Is it anywhere near a carcinogenic level? I mean, how big is this problem?
The impact on humans and other living organisms is now being investigated. So it's something that we've become aware that it's ubiquitous in the environment. We have the evidence that it's being taken up passively and actively by animals who are, say, a filter feeder or just absorbing it in the foods that they eat as they swim through the ocean. And then the next larger fish eats that fish and you get that bioaccumulation, it's called.
Sure.
And there's also just the ingestion of larger pieces of plastic that that we're familiar with, you know, horrible pictures of sea turtles, you know, or sea birds choking on plastic. The actual impact of that is really still being understood or still being researched. So what we do know is that, you know, at the macro level, plastic can look like food. It can choke animals. It can fill up their stomachs and not get digested and prevent them from ingesting enough, you know, actual food to survive. That's at the macro level. For the microplastics, what we see is that the chemical structure of plastic is such that it attracts and holds on to other chemicals. So it'll accumulate toxins in the particles. So there's obviously good and bad materials floating through all of the world, even naturally. But plastics will accumulate those. So things like mercury, right? Or any kind of you know, pesticides or, you know, any kind of industrial chemical, things like this that we know are bad can get kind of glommed on to microplastics and accumulate that way. So when an animal ingests microplastics, it's also ingesting a nice little, you know, pizza topping selection of other harmful chemicals. And that's what's accumulated. And there's been some studies that are showing that that kind of accumulation of toxins can affect the endocrine systems of animals, or, you know, other impacts on their health, you know, their longevity, how long do they live, how energetic they are. And those kinds of effects, while maybe not life and death for each individual animal, can cause big shifts in, you know, in the population dynamics. And that kind of impact can really throw things off. So that's the potential. And it's now being researched, you know, to what degree is that happening? And, you know, where is it worst? What can we do to mitigate those problems?
Andrew, are you still working with National Geographic?
Not directly, no. I left there last year when it came to Adventure Scientist, but I still have a lot of friends that are over there, and I'm happy to hear that David Quammen is coming on the show later.
I know. What a coincidence.
This is the Bozeman, Montana show.
Yeah.
So you know him then?
Yeah, we have met a couple of times.
Okay, good.
So say I'm an adventurer. Say I'm going to go climb K2 next month. Or say I'm just going to go to a lake in the Adirondacks to go canoeing. And I want to help out. I want to collect data. How do I do it? And do I get to choose my project? Do I go through this list of projects that you guys have going on now? And I go, oh, I like that one. I'll do that one.
Yeah, it depends on your flexibility and our selection of projects at the time. So if you go on to adventurescientist.org or follow us on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram, you'll always see information about our latest and greatest projects. The nature of the research and projects is there's always new ones coming on, there's things that are in full swing, and there's things that are starting to phase out. So our microplastics project has wrapped up data collection, but now it's up to the researchers, and we're doing a lot of the analysis and spreading the word and the availability of that data.
Yeah.
Our timber project has been active this summer, and that's been all up and down the West Coast from San Diego up to Vancouver, people going out and collecting big leaf maple samples, leaves or wood samples that are going to be used to build a genetic database to enable us to pinpoint the origin of timber that's suspected of being illegally harvested. With that kind of tool, we can kind of we can put in real hard facts to as evidence against people that are illegally harvesting timber and have heretofore been able to pass it off because it's been really hard to say where did this really come from. So that's been an active project up and down the West Coast of North America. We're also collecting pollinator samples where people go out, photograph butterflies, wildflowers all throughout the Mountain West, and that's giving us a clearer picture of biodiversity in the backcountry.
Yeah.
And so kind of, this summer, depending on where you live, there were different projects that you could get involved with. Also, depending on what skill you are, sometimes we have something that requires, collection of snow or ice samples from high mountain areas, so that's perfect for there. Other times it's water samples from freshwater. We'll do a survey of river quality. So there's always new projects kind of taking shape. So the best thing you can do is follow us at adventurescientist.org and on social media and just see what's coming.
Excellent. Andrew Holley of Adventure Scientist, based out of Bozeman, Montana. Really interesting work that you do. You must just love it. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.